Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all of the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Paul Matisse, and Grace Colon, with special guest Yuval Cohen, CEO of Corbus. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So offerings have been very strong lately, with the first few IPOs of 2024 going well, upsizing, pricing at the higher end of the range. And of course, we saw CG Oncology last week trading up significantly. Some notable offerings this week include Immunocore, which priced an upsized convertible note Monday, raising about $352 million. This was launched with the stock close to 52-week highs, achieving a conversion price in excess of all-time highs, according to JP Morgan. We also saw Vaxcyte price a $750 million public offering of stock and pre-funded warrants, selling shares at a slight discount. And then following the offering, Vaxcyte stock had risen well above the offering price. And we continue to see more of these wall-crossed pipes. Tyra Biosciences raised a $200 million pipe, led by RA, with a bunch of other specialists participating. You'll recall that when we asked Peter Kolchinsky on the show a few weeks ago whether these wall-crossed pipes disadvantage non-specialists and could make biotech less attractive to generalists over time, he wasn't too concerned by that. And then Tim Oppler made the case that generalists would also be welcome to be wall-crossed, that these pipes primarily disadvantage retail investors. Lastly, I saw that Alto Neurosciences IPO priced an upsized $120 million at the top of the range, but it hadn't traded yet when I last checked. So would any of you like to comment on any of these companies or market dynamics more broadly? One other interesting thing we're seeing is companies that were previously in the microcap range raising money and actually seeing double-digit stock appreciation. Perspective and Corbus being two examples. And I think every microcap investor probably wants to see the next Trillium, which went from $16 million to a $2.1 billion market cap in 2 years under the leadership of Jan Skvarka. But that's really tough to do. Josh, I know you've often talked about the spiral that happens once a company goes below $100 million market cap and how hard it is to get out because of both the financial overhang, the lack of attention, and also, frankly, some listing rules that make it difficult. It looks like Corbus could be, you know, on that path of actually being one of those rare situations. It was up 300% on data, did a raise to clear out the financing overhang, and that raise was pretty well received. Even Adam Feuerstein pointed out, who tends to be more on the skeptical side, pointed out that the raise of $86 million was three times their market cap last month. So Josh, I'd love to get your thoughts on this and then have you lead the discussion with Yuval Cohen, Corbus CEO, who's been kind enough to join us today.
Sure. Yuval, it's great to have you with us. And as we've talked about, the gravitational pull of low valuations can be very challenging for companies, in part just because the ability to raise capital to fund programs can be prohibitively high. For companies, so it's unfortunately a little bit of a death spiral type situation. Even when companies might have a good asset, it can be done. We've seen it done. Probably one of the most dramatic recent examples of late is Cabaletta Bio, right? Who's now, I think, flirting with a billion-dollar type market cap after its lows around 30 to 50 million. But what's really helped, and I think relevant to Corbus as well, to escape from that valuation drag is a very different narrative, right? And Corbus is I think a great example of a company that's on a new life with a new platform and a new asset that is starting to get the attention of investors. So I think there are a couple of important lessons around this in terms of, you know, first, companies that are able to essentially reinvent themselves after failure by finding new assets. And oftentimes those can make for some of the best investment opportunities because it takes time for investors to recognize what's happening and to realize that there's a new narrative, and certainly experience that to a substantial degree with Cabaletta, who's now become a much more broadly known and appreciated biotech company in the CAR-T immunology space. But again, like when things aren't going well, it's not always the end of a biotech company. It's up to the leadership team and the management team to forge a new path. So Yuval, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how that's evolved at Corbus and where you are now.
So thank you so much for inviting me, Josh. It's wonderful talking to you again. So just a little bit, I think just touching on the points you raised. Yes, we had a really an almost near-death experience back in late 2020 when our single asset really did not work in phase three. And that was pretty traumatic. We had to go from about 200 people down to eventually 18 and make some really tough decisions. One of the most difficult decisions was what to do next. And what we decided collectively as management and as a board was two things. One, not to try and roll the dice again on the asset that had failed. And secondly, to go out and rebuild the company around a completely novel, in a new direction, a completely different pivot, different mechanisms of action, different indications. And so we went from focusing with a small molecule on the cannabinoid type 2 receptor in rare autoimmune diseases to go out there and shop for biologics in solid tumors where we could potentially leverage a biomarker. And that was immensely challenging for many, many reasons. It was a huge learning curve and just very labor intensive. There are a lot of assets out there, and some are great and some are not. But the rule of thumb is the ones that are really easy to recognize as great tend to be prohibitively expensive. The ones that are very, very cheap, very often there's a reason why they're not very expensive. But we had conviction and we had a vision, and we found two of these. And we found ourselves just committed to this. And it was a very significant gamble in that sense. I'd like to say that, you know, it was a very calculated risk, and it was in many ways, but I also want to acknowledge we were also immensely lucky. And I do want that to, I don't want hindsight to sort of cloud our vision. But we did it, and the asset turned out to be what we had hoped for. In fact, it exceeded our expectations. And what we did, Josh and everyone, was we spent, we've only had this asset for under a year, is we spent an enormous amount of time engaging with the buy side and just educating them, not just around the asset, but also around our pivot, that we were a different company. I guess my last point is we had really very spirited debates around whether or not to change our name. And I think good points were made for both sides. And ultimately, what I decided was to keep our name. I wanted to own it. I wanted to own our past. I wanted to own the painful lessons. And I didn't want to, I didn't want us to forget that, even though, even symbolically, I did not want us to forget it.
So not only did you switch the therapeutic category focus, and not only did you switch the modality focus, you switched to one of the more complex modalities that often requires tremendous specialized expertise. Now maybe in the setting where the drug's further advanced, you don't necessarily need some of the design capabilities and expertise and linkers and payloads, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how you made that transition and, you know, what kind of people you needed with you to get comfortable with an ADC therapeutic.
So one of the lessons that we took away from our first experience was being a first-in-class, or in our case, an only in class, is really exciting scientifically. And if it works, the outcome is very gratifying, but But there is a downside, which is you're jumping off a cliff. It is blind faith. And we never wanted to do that again. What attracted us to this asset, and in fact, the other asset we have as well, were we were not the first ones. And what we were trying to do is find an asset that improves in a tangible, understandable way on something that's out there. And so in our case, for example, with CRB701, the idea behind it is Padcev from what used to be Seagen is now Pfizer, is a Nectin-4 ADC with MMAE that has really very attractive efficacy, but has tolerability issues. And that's what needs to be fixed. And this was another Nectin-4 ADC with MMAE, but with one of these novel linkers, and there are quite a few of these novel linkers out there, that was designed to improve on the therapeutic window. So that for me was an idea that I could wrap my head around easily, and that was relatively very simple to explain to other parties, to the buy side, etc. If you juxtapose it, for example, had we gone with, as you mentioned, for example, a different warhead, a different payload, there are many things that are very attractive about a non-MMAE, let alone a very novel payload, but you just don't know if it's going to work or not, because there's nothing that you can use as a standard. And after our first experience, we kind of wanted to keep the drama to a minimum and have as much certainty as we could possibly build in into the hypothesis.
Maybe give us a snapshot of the data that was recently presented, and then, you know, how you're thinking of advancing the program now that we are starting to see an explosion of ADC innovation, and, you know, finding that room to navigate where others aren't ahead, or finding paths to differentiate are just increasingly important.
Sure. So a couple of thoughts. One, like so many other ADC deals we've seen over the last year and a half or so, this ADC also comes from a Chinese pharmaceutical company. China has become a real powerhouse in ADC, especially linker chemistry. And so we went out there shopping, and we ended up bringing in this asset from CSPC Pharmaceuticals in China. The other thing we leveraged, which I think also has become now a template, is at the moment you do the study, the deal, typically your Chinese partner is already starting in the clinic or generating some clinical data. And that was the case with us. In fact, they had dosed their first patient the week before we signed the licensing deal. And so the data that was released at ASCO GU last Friday, although it feels like it was about a million years ago, was the first look into the first six cohorts of a pretty vanilla dose escalation study in late stage metastatic patients. It's a mixture of bladder cancer patients and other Nectin-4 enriched patients with enriched tumors. And I think what the buy side and others liked about it or appreciated about it was that the safety data so far, and it is early days, but so far does look differentiated, and that it seems to be driven both preclinically and now in the clinic by a different pharmacokinetic profile. These novel stable linkers with their site-specific conjugations seem to have less of a collateral damage issue when it comes to the payload. I think lastly, the two things that stood out to the buy side were the following. So far to date, we are not seeing the two type of side effects that have been immensely difficult or challenging for Padcev, and these are peripheral neuropathy and skin rash. And the other thing is that we have seen reactions or clinical responses both in the bladder cancer patient. So that's reassuring. That's almost your positive control, but also intriguingly in cervical cancer patients, and cervical tumors are known to be very Nectin-4 enriched. So I think what we did is we set expectations appropriately and managed to a certain extent exceed those expectations.
Excellent. Well, congrats on the progress, and looking forward to more updates.
Yeah, congratulations. Thanks, Yuval, for joining us. And you should stay up here and comment as a co-host on the rest of the show. So there were a few other important data readouts this week. We had Vertex and Sarepta. Paul, do you want to talk about both of those?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, thanks, Daphne. So on Vertex, they had their highly anticipated data for their a couple acute pain trials for their non-opioid product that works through a sodium channel, NaV1.8, that's been genetically validated. And this comes on the back of a number of positive studies before, and a study in chronic pain that came out this fall. The context here, and Vertex has traded off since these data, is that there was already a lot of expectation here that these studies would work and that this drug has blockbuster potential. And ultimately, probably much hasn't really changed after these data on that, even though the stock traded down. And I think, our view at least is that this drug sets up the best in the chronic pain setting. Where patients are on drug for longer and the actual issues associated with opioid use are much more salient, right? The nuance in these data was that in one of the two trials, and they ran a bunionectomy trial and an abdominoplasty trial, they underperformed the opioid arm pretty significantly. And it creates a controversy, right, as it relates to the acute setting for use. How much does efficacy matter? Are opioids really that problematic if it's for a short period of time, and the expectation is this drug will be more expensive? But ultimately, I think that this drug is still going to be seen as something by the street that has blockbuster potential, because now, kind of like with the muscarinics, right, we've got five, six positive studies in a row for this mechanism. It's pretty clear it works, and it's pretty clear that there's broad potential. Anyone else want to opine quickly before I move on? Maybe then I'll switch gears to the Sarepta data for their PPMO drug. So this was in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And basically, the idea here is that the first generation drugs that are exon skippers that make dystrophin, they work a little, right? Like Exondys makes, 1% of normal dystrophin over time. But the issue is poor biodistribution to muscle. And this has been an issue in the brain as well, with trying to administer drugs either directly or IV or even with oral pills. And so, in the context of this, we've talked about this before on Hangout. It's kind of given the way to a whole, host of companies that are working on novel delivery technologies in muscle and the brain. So Sarepta's just read out in a later stage study and essentially showed with their conjugate, which is a charged peptide that can boost drug uptake in muscle, they're getting around 5% of normal dystrophin for this candidate, 5051. Whereas they were getting less than 1% for Exondys. The interesting nuance here, and there's some implications for the space, but the interesting nuance here is that it looks like Sarepta, and we confirm this with them, that they are calculating dystrophin differently in these trials. So they're adjusting the dystrophin number for fat in the muscle, which, at least if you look at Exondys as kind of an analog, does look like it leads you to backing into a higher amount of calculated dystrophin. But nonetheless, any way you cut it, they're probably getting 6x, 7x as much dystrophin with this next gen product. And while there are safety issues with these peptides, specifically related to renal tox, it looked like from these data that it was manageable. PepGen, a competitor of Sarepta's, who has technology that is very, very similar, but with some healthy volunteer and animal data, with all the caveats that come with those data, that looks promising competitively, traded up a lot in these results, given implied validation, and other companies to watch here that are focused on delivery technologies and muscle include Dyne, who I think we'll kind of mention briefly after a Bloomberg article on them last week. They had some initial data in DMD for their lowest dose, and then they're going to have more data later this year, and then Avidity and Trata, and there will likely be other players here, I think, as well.
Do you want to mention Dyne since we're on that subject? And then I want to talk about two stories that are sort of in contrast with each other. So go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, I guess the other story, and as this muscle space heats up, is there was a Bloomberg article last Friday that Dyne is weighing options after receiving takeover interest. This was one of those articles, and the way it was depicted is it sounded as though, there's interest, they're figuring out what they're going to do. Buyers or interested buyers may make an offer, or they may wait for more data to make an offer. We put out a report on this and laid out our perspective on it. And I guess sort of taking a step back, right? I mean, as is probably clear from my commentary on the Sarepta data, there is a huge opportunity for novel delivery technologies in these genetic muscle diseases, given the unmet need and given the breadth of potential, right? Dyne is focused on DMD, but most of their value right now, in my opinion at least, is derived from their myotonic dystrophy program. I think the interesting question here is whether or not an interested buyer would be confident enough to pay a substantial premium on the data generated to date, or if they would want to see, another cohort or two of data. But I think more broadly, it does look like the Dyne platform works. And it's not shocking that there would be interest given that, not just DMD as an attractive market, but myotonic dystrophy specifically is a huge unmet need. And it's more prevalent than cystic fibrosis, right? So it's one of those orphan markets, that could really move the needle regardless of company size.
Thanks, Paul. So I thought there was two stories that are sort of related, I guess, in some way. One is that Biogen ending development and sales of aducanumab for Alzheimer's disease, and sort of I think just that story ending on a kind of sad note, and then the evaluate most the list of most anticipated drug launches, in which donanemab is one of the top most anticipated. So I'd love to hear, Grace, what did you think about the Evaluate Pharma list of most anticipated drug launches, and then have you, Paul, talk about Biogen and aducanumab.
Sure, thanks. Hi. This list is always interesting every year because obviously, there's a lot of speculation that doesn't come to pass. So a couple of the interesting trends here. If you look at the list, which is based on Evaluate's annual preview, the total number of sales anticipated, 5 years after the list comes out has dramatically dropped. So in 2022, the estimate of 5 year forward sales for the top 10 drugs was about $27 billion. And this year it's about $15 billion. So I think it's a combination of, not truly anticipating the challenges, both the regulatory and the launch uptake challenges of a lot of these drugs. And also some of these drugs have actually been on the list several times now, like Lilly's donanemab, right? Where it was on the list in 2022, then 2023, and now again, they finally hope this will be the year that'll come out. And also, by the way, what's interesting about that drug is the estimates in 2022 for peak sales, not peak sales, but 5 year forward sales was $6 billion. And now they're being a lot more conservative at $2 billion. But this list came out a couple of days before the Biogen announcement. But I don't think that's really going to impact the sales there, since it's not really competing with that drug. But I'd like to have you talk about, Daphne, the number one drug on the list, which was Karuna's drug, which was just acquired a few weeks ago by BMS for $14 billion and was founded by your company, PureTech. So do you want to say a couple words about KarXT?
Oh yeah, thank you. So KarXT was invented at PureTech, but I will note that the one of the components of KarXT's xanomeline was originally developed at Eli Lilly, and Steve Paul was the president of R&D at Eli Lilly, both, you know, in developing xanomeline, but also when donanemab was developed. So he is two for two at the top of the list. And yeah, so I thought the list was really interesting and obviously very exciting to see KarXT at the top. You know, I think a lot of anticipation around that, that drug launching, especially for patients. But yeah, I don't know, Paul, if you want to comment on any of that, and then love to hear you talk about aducanumab.
Sure. Well, you know, Daphne, that I've been, you know, a huge bull and optimist on the muscarinic space for a while, since before, or since I guess right after the Karuna phase two data, and then, you know, with Cerevel. And I would just add that, you know, we hosted a public call yesterday with three psychiatrists on a bunch of topics, and all three of them unanimously agreed that muscarinic drugs could be used in 40 to 50% of schizophrenia patients and not that long, which is an unbelievable number, right? I mean, I think Wall Street expectations are high, and I think that would be significantly higher than what was expected. You know, I thought separately just on the Biogen news yesterday for them discontinuing aducanumab, it's almost surprising that they waited this long to do so. You know, I think some folks thought that this could have been, you know, from a spending perspective, something easier to cut early on when Chris Viehbacher joined and, you know, they reorganized a number of things around their operating line. You know, I think the implications really are that this drug, you know, throw away even the kind of controversial history of it and whether or not you could really kind of get rid of that out of prescribers' minds. You know, this drug was looking like it was too much of a Gen 1.0 antibody, even if the next trial worked, because it has a higher rate of ARIA, and it's not clear that it could be delivered subcutaneously. So, you know, when investors think about this space now, you know, it's been really an emotional roller coaster, right? And I think the hope had been that even though there was a thought that these launches would be slow, right? The lecanemab launch so far, and we'll see what happens with donanemab, has been really slow. It's been slower than expected. And when you talk to clinicians in this space, you know, outside of some debate around the clinical data and clinical meaningfulness, the much bigger impediment is just the infrastructure required to give these products, you know, with diagnosis, PET scans, IV infusions. And so donanemab will be super interesting because the drug is given less frequently, once monthly IV versus lecanemab, twice per month. And there's a possible idea that you might not have to give it chronically, right? They've developed it so you get patients to amyloid negative and then just do sort of a watch and wait. You know, and I think that that theoretically, given the bottleneck issues here, could be really, really attractive. The complicating factor with donanemab still is that it has a higher rate of ARIA, the brain swelling signal. And so how that kind of works out in the real world with monitoring and things like that, I think is still somewhat of an open question. But I think, you know, even just taking a step back beyond donanemab, I think 2024 is really the pivotal year for this whole amyloid class and in proving out to skeptical investors that these are going to be really meaningful drugs in Alzheimer's and not just super niche.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've also been thinking a lot about this topic of how management and deal making can create and on the other side destroy shareholder value. And aducanumab is a good example of the latter. The previous management at Biogen, not Chris Viehbacher, you know, they made some choices that I think were, you know, were destructive regarding aducanumab. And I thought we saw a few interesting deals this week that I'd like to open up to the group to discuss whether these deals created or destroyed value and what else could have been done. So the one that really stood out to me was Regeneron buying 270 Bio's cell therapy pipeline minus its marketed BCMA CAR T therapy, Abecma, for $5 million upfront and a single $10 million milestone payment. So 270 is going to focus on Abecma together with partnered BMS, which has been trying to compete against J&J's Carvykti. So criticism was raised that 270 Bio invested billions of dollars into its programs. And I think part of that might have been also in its previous iteration at Bluebird. And this is not a great outcome. I'm not sure if any of you have been following this company, either Bluebird or 270. And what do you think the company should or could have done differently. So I will ask, you know, anyone to jump in, but otherwise I'll put Josh on the spot.
All right. What could they have done differently to avoid selling, you know, their a big chunk of the company and all that money invested for just $5 million to Regeneron? It was kind of clear for years that the burn at the company was fairly exorbitant. And even when it had a much more robust cash position, that the cash wasn't going to last forever. And there was it was just hard to understand why the burn was as high as it was. Now, some of it is obviously just having to build the infrastructure for cell therapy manufacturing and launch, which itself is very, very expensive. Now, perhaps if Abecma had had a stronger adoption curve, you know, maybe that's, you know, that was kind of the one thing that tripped them up the most, the fact that Carvykti from Legend and J&J emerged with just a stronger product profile, ways that are actually kind of hard to really even understand why one would be as better as another. It just gets into the big black box of CAR T therapies that we just can't really solve for. But if it weren't, arguably, if it weren't for Legend and J&J, it wouldn't have come to this. But you know, on the other hand, we've known about Legend and J&J for years, and the robust nature of the Carvykti data. So you know, it's also not surprising to see failure in biotech, just because the company's invested tens, hundreds, or billions of dollars in a program doesn't guarantee success. It is a reminder of just how costly some of the cell and gene therapy approaches can be, especially for companies that ultimately make it. As far as Bluebird/270 ultimately made it. And the fact that they weren't able to find a buyer other than Regeneron at $5 million up front perhaps reflects as well the proliferation of cell and gene therapy capabilities in the industry. And so who was out there who actually wanted this as part of their portfolio and was willing to not only invest in the upfront, but obviously all the spending that comes afterwards. You know, so just an interesting glimpse of a company that, you know, has been in trouble for some time. From a financial perspective, they've already had to restructure not too long ago. I think the question now is, you know, they believe that this transaction now will let their cash stretch to 2027. Bristol reported Abecma revenue today as part of their fourth quarter earnings. It looks like the U.S. revenue remains fairly suppressed. They did grow ex-U.S., and so now the question is, can, on a global basis, Abecma deliver enough revenue for 270 to be able to reach profitability in the coming months or years?
I love the fact that I put you on the spot and you just jumped right in. That's pretty cool. All right, so another deal on the more positive side was Protagonist and Takeda announcing co-development, co-commercialization deal for Protagonist's injectable peptide, currently in phase three. There was a $300 million upfront payment from Takeda. Investors seem to react favorably to the news, and on the positive side, it helps de-risk things ahead of the launch. On the downside, it may make an acquisition less likely. So that's sort of another flavor of deal that I think you get some controversy around is when somebody does partners, you know, an important program, and instead of sort of setting up the company for an M&A. Any thoughts on that one, Grace or Yuval? If I see Josh, you want to comment, go ahead.
Well, I'll just note that a lot of the focus on Protagonist now is the oral IL-23 inhibitor that they have partnered with J&J, and the royalties that they'll ultimately received from that program, and you know, for that to potentially be a multi-billion dollar product in the very large I&I field, there's I think just been as a result less focus on the heme program, the hepcidin program, and still a little bit of uncertainty in terms of how that's going to fit into the treatment armamentarium of polycythemia vera and/or other disease indications. So, no, but definitely a program we've been following, and nice to see them with a partner such as Takeda.
Great. And then the third deal that caught my eye was AVROBIO announcing reverse merger with GPCR-focused Tectonic Therapeutics. AVRO's stock dropped about 16% on the news. So there had been some mixed reactions, with some pointing out that AVRO, it's a Tim Springer co-founded company, top-tier investors, very strong team, CEO is terrific. While some other people noted that they would have preferred a straightforward payout of assets. So this is another type of discussion that we see when, a company has a setback, should they just pay out or, explore reverse mergers? And we've talked about that in the past. So moving to the advocacy side, really nice to see bio and other industry groups make progress on some important fixes to issues that have come up for our industry. And this week we saw a bipartisan R&D tax credit restoration bio passed by the House. I know bio was very involved in that. Grace, we talk a lot about the IRA on this podcast, and it's been great working with you on the board of bio on some of these initiatives to fix these problems. Can you summarize some of the important advocacy progress that's actually been made very recently?
Sure, happy to. And as you mentioned, there is a tremendous amount of work going on within bio and other related groups like No Patient Left Behind to actually address some of the more egregious and impactful bits of the IRA. And so you just addressed one, which was the restoration of the R&D tax credit. So instead of being amortized over 5 years, you can actually take the credit in the given year. And that's especially important for early stage biotech. And then in addition to that, we have obviously the Orphan Cures Act, which is making its way through, as well as other efforts that kind of complement all of this. So there was a letter that was written to the Congressional Budget Office that was led by No Patient Left Behind, and a press release was issued where the goal was really to make the CBO more aware of the full impact of the way they do their analysis of the impact of the IRA, where they essentially concluded that it wouldn't really reduce innovation, that the reduction in total investment was not going to be significant, and it wouldn't reduce the number of drugs actually brought to market. And there are just some egregious errors and really not taking into account the real-world experience of investors and how they make decisions, particularly into early-stage investment. So, for example, with the pill bill, the 9 versus 13, which also was introduced this week, and I'll talk about in a minute. The issue is that if investors are looking at the fact that after 9 years, a small molecule will be subject to negotiation, they're going to be a lot less likely to invest because they're plugging into their NPV models the actual duration of effective exclusivity. And so what happens is you have fewer classes of drugs or fewer drugs entering a particular class because they're looking at when price reductions will happen for that class. And all of a sudden, when these drugs eventually go generic, you don't have as much choice for the patients. You don't have the ability of kind of second and third fast followers coming in that it may have a better profile. And so you have these knock-on effects, which ultimately harms patients as well as the industry. And so I think making them aware of some of these nuances and actually looking at the longer term impact of innovation and all the benefit that accrues to society as we take these risks and make these investments, it's really important. And what was interesting is the CBO director, Philip Swagel, there's actually a little clip on the No Patient Left Behind website where he actually talks about the letter and the fact that it was signed by both investors and CEOs representing over 600 drugs in development and $300 billion in assets under management really caught his attention. And at least in the hearing, actually spoke about you know, we're actually going to engage in discussion. We understand, we want to talk about our models and the assumptions we make. So we're hoping that this will have an impact. The introduction of the pill, what we're calling the pill bill, which is actually, hoping to address this disparity, actually happened this week. It was introduced by Congressman Greg Murphy, who's actually an MD, alongside Congressman Don Davis and Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee Chair Brett Guthrie. And what's interesting is we're seeing more bipartisan activity here. And the intention of this particular bill is actually to restore basically even the stakes. So instead of having 9 years for small molecules and 13 years for biologics, it's actually suggesting they're both 13 years, and actually that can work for the industry. And so we're hoping that, and obviously BIO has been doing a lot of time, a lot of advocacy, not only in DC, but actually meeting in the local districts with biotech innovators and investors, meeting with local representatives to actually educate them on the potential harm to the industry. And obviously all this activity is also complemented by a number of state lawsuits about the IRA in a variety of districts, and those are progressing. Some have completed their briefs and some are still, working towards that. And so it'll be interesting because we'll begin to see some of those progress this year. And obviously the government has to win all of those or else we're gonna have issues, or they're gonna have issues with the IRA. So I think all of this is positive for the industry, and it's coming at a time that there is renewed optimism, as we've been talking about, in terms of the IPO market opening up and additional investment. And also just alluding a little bit earlier to the top 10 list, one of the interesting things this year is a number of smaller companies are making it on the list, and a number of truly potentially disease-modifying drugs are, hoping to get approved, such as sotatercept for PAH, which is a huge market and huge unmet need. And that's the first truly disease modifying one. We have a number of others, such as Geron's drug, and we have drugs in COPD and NASH, areas that have traditionally been very, very challenging. So, all of this, I think, is very good for the industry. But it's important to always remember that we have to keep our eye on the ball with respect to advocacy, because a lot of times it's easy to forget that all this stuff is going on, but it's important that people participate, use their voices. BIO's going to be holding a series of town halls in key cities this year, and we're inviting CEOs and other members of the industry to participate and help us think about how we can make this industry sustainable going forward. So those are some of the key updates. Oh, the other one is the mifepristone final amicus was filed on Tuesday. The one, at least ours, the one from the industry, a number of others are working their way as well. And these are expected to, the Supreme Court is expected to hear oral arguments in March with a decision expected by June. So a lot happening on all these fronts this year, and obviously we'll keep you posted.
Hey, Grace, can I ask you a question? I think one thing that is interesting when I talk to other investors about the IRA, especially those who are pessimistic, is they worry that, drug pricing and controlling drug costs has just become something that, one of the few things it feels like, that has true bipartisan support. And, whether or not that's true, I do think one challenge is really having, a layperson, a non-expert, kind of understand drugs and drug value and think past sticker price. And so beyond engaging with political leaders, what do you think BIO or the industry can do to actually, educate just an everyday person on, drug prices and drug cost and, why controlling price in this way is actually not in, everyone's best interest?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, Paul, because I do think that there's a great deal of misunderstanding about healthcare costs. And I think that's primarily driven, if you look at the average layperson, they're looking at their copays, they're looking at their deductibles, and then they're hearing, of course, obviously, journalists like to, really highlight bad actors in the industry, of which we know there are. But the vast majority of the industry, the vast majority of the people who work in this industry just really want to drive innovation. They want to help patients. Many of them are motivated by that. So I think patient stories are really important, reminding people of what the industry does. The other thing that's important is, you know, increasing transparency on how broken the value chain is when you look at PBMs and when you look at the fact that even the provider system, you know, of the trillions of dollars of healthcare spend in this country, only 15% is actually drugs. And the vast majority of it is middlemen, it's ineffective services, it's lack of transparency, it's unequal pricing in terms of, you know, hospitals and procedures. And so it's very, very complicated. And there's increasing consolidation in the industry, both in the provider and the PBM and the payer space. So it's really a mess. And it's very easy to just look at one thing at drug companies. They see the DTC ads and they see, you know, they read about all this stuff and, you know, we're big bad pharma. So I think it's not easy, but I think, you know, bringing it back to patients, we've actually pushed very hard on the PBM side and we're seeing a lot of traction there. The other thing is educating the other side of the aisle, right? Many of us, you know, agree with a lot of the policies of, you know, some might be on different sides of the aisle, but one thing that resonates with legislators is innovation and economic growth in their districts. So one of the things we're doing is reaching out to districts that are blue that might be, you know, really supporting this kind of drug price, simple sort of drug pricing fixes, and actually educating them and their staff on the industry and how it really works. And how biotech can really be a driver of growth, not just because of the drug company jobs, but also the entire value chain of the industry, the CROs, the research, academia. So I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen. But you're right. I mean, people think big bad pharma, you know, stories get a lot of attention. So it really is multi-pronged. But that's one of the things that I know, and I know Daphne, probably you, that motivated us to get involved with bio because this industry is so important.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was impressed by the fact that we did talk to, you know, Democrats and others, and their staff seemed to be really open-minded. And once they sort of understood a little bit more about how drugs are developed and the sort of biotech innovation ecosystem, they seem to be very open. I think the problem sometimes is when you have big pharma companies coming with their narrative and, you know, it's a different story there. And, you know, I also think the pandemic and vaccines did some damage to us because, you know, people see that companies like Pfizer and Moderna, they were like making, you know, double digit millions in profit. You know, and so I think that this concept of these bigger companies profiting off of health is one that we have to counterbalance with the idea that, you know, biotech is hard and there's, you know, entrepreneurship, business, you know, job creation, small business, and, you know, all of that element of the industry, I think probably would play better in the public domain. So I know, Josh, you had a couple of comments that you wanted to make on Vanda and Janet Woodcock exiting and her interview there with Endpoints.
Yeah, just Vanda, just some of the interesting things that go on in our industry. So Vanda had filed for FDA approval of their melatonin analog Hetlioz for treatment of jet lag, which is kind of a different indication than what we're used to thinking about, and they received a CRL from the FDA, I think it was a couple of years ago already, and the FDA never gave an explanation for the CRL, and Vanda wound up suing the FDA. Vanda's actually had a number of little skirmishes with the FDA over varying issues, one of which was even a requirement for animal model testing. And, you know, years later, a district court ruled that the FDA basically has to give Vanda an explanation or approve the drug for jet lag. So you very rarely see this. You also have to wonder whether Vanda's being a bit of a thorn in the side of the FDA led to that kind of FDA backlash in terms of not giving them any real clarity underlying their CRL. So it was just kind of a notable little oddity from the biopharma sector this week. As well, there is an interesting exit interview with Janet Woodcock in Endpoint News, where she also laments a little bit about some of the FDA advisory AdCom meetings that can turn into circuses at times and full of drama, and actually advocated for input from advisory groups, perhaps not at the end of the process when to scrutinize data, but at the beginning of the process to optimize trial designs and outcome measures, etc., which I thought was a very provocative take on the role of the FDA AdComs and how we can get more value out of them.
And that makes so much sense too. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that they don't do that. So, looping back to the topic of leadership, I saw an interesting post from someone named Sahil Bloom about leadership and tennis, where they talk about how amateur tennis is a game where 80% of points are lost on errors, and you win by avoiding errors and waiting for your opponent to make errors. So it's what they were calling a loser's game. And then professional tennis is a winner's game where 80% of points are won on incredible shots. And the idea that Sahil shared is that you need to know which game you're playing. And what he said is that earlier in your career, it's more like amateur tennis where you execute and avoid mistakes. But in later career, it's a winner's game where outsized rewards go to those who make really magnificent shots. And I was thinking about this, with regard to biotech, and I think biotech leaders need to play both games. So you kind of have to avoid errors, but also really primarily focus on hitting the incredible shots. And just thinking about how this industry is pretty hard. Grace and Yuval, do you have any thoughts on that or any of the leadership themes that we've talked about throughout today's show? And we'll go around and just make some closing remarks because we're near the end.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that post. I thought that was really interesting. I think the one thing that I would kind of think about is the idea that, well, you're very cautious and you try not to make major mistakes. There was some aspect to the post that, or earlier in your career, and I know I personally made so many big mistakes. And I think it's a combination. I think you might not expect to win, but I do feel like, going into it with an idea that it's okay to take risks as long as and you learn from your mistakes, I think is really important. And some people are fortunate. They have those big wins, earlier in their career. But I think you're right. I think mindset is critically important as you're navigating, because it's, for example, in biotech, as we said, it's really, really challenging. And so I think it's important to not have a mindset of, you have to win every single time, because we know the statistics in this industry.
Thanks, Daphne, for the question. I
I think,
think just to
Daphne, I thought that was really interesting. That's a really interesting comment just about careers. And I think from a biotech CEO perspective, at least on the investor side, I'd be curious if Josh agrees, but I think, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the credibility of an executive is often, sometimes maybe not unfairly, but just for is what it is, right? Kind of judging on whether or not the drug works. And the people are probably judging a lot of things that are out of their control, but I guess my initial reaction to that is avoiding errors is probably worth a lot more than getting wins. I mean, you need some winning, don't get me wrong, but I think investors have a real long, sometimes maybe even too long memory for an error or a misjudgment in a communication or an overpromise and undeliver. I mean, without naming any names, I mean, you'd be surprised at some executives of really well-established companies where just chatter I've heard from an investor here or there on something they might have said a really long time ago about a trial or a drug issue that didn't pan out is not forgotten. So, I whenever I give executives advice on communications with the street, I'm always just pounding it home to be like super conservative and really underpromise, because I think overly selling the dream is an error that can backfire really often.
It's a really interesting point you make about occurs. So I think that there's kind of a differentiation between the errors that you could make in either, you know, running the company, running a study, or communicating with investors. And then there's the other side of it, which is, you know, not errors, but things that just go wrong in the industry. So like if your study fails, and like, I think that what's interesting about it is, for example, in Yuval's example, he, you know, he did, you know, there was a failure, but he actually, you know, after that did everything right and, you know, turned the company around and found a new asset and all that. So I think that there's probably an important distinction between errors versus things going wrong. And sometimes those two things get connected in a way that they shouldn't, because some of, you know, the things going right or wrong, some of that is good judgment and good planning. And, you know, a lot of it is luck. Whereas the, you know, sort of amateurish errors are things that you learn not to make, and you have to be careful not to make, even if you're trying to aim for a big win. So I just think it's a really fascinating topic.
Totally.
Yuval, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I agree with everyone's points of views. I just say a couple of things. One is, it's a cliche, but just we need to be careful of hindsight. Like you said, Daphne, you could fail a study because you designed it badly or executed it badly. And sometimes you fail a study because the drug just doesn't work, or the science was just not well understood. But what I wanted to add is the value of optimism, especially internally facing. If you're a CEO, unless you've got a workforce of exactly one person, there are other people there that are working with you and for you, and they look up to you, and you cannot be a pessimist. I think you need to be a realist and a pragmatist, but it's really important to just give them a sense of hope and a sense of what could happen if things work out well. I think the mistake of being overly pessimistic, overly cautious, can be very, very challenging for a corporate culture, especially in such a risky industry as ours.
Yeah, it's a really great point. You know, it's sort of balancing the optimism with real, you know, what's realistic going to happen, and I think also an appropriate level of transparency internally and externally to build that credibility. So when you are optimistic, people believe you. But anyway, this is a fascinating topic. I would like to have Josh maybe make some closing remarks, and then we'll close out the room.
Not just a dynamic week. One thought from me on the top 10 list of drugs to watch in 2024 is that once you move out of the top, you know, three or four, it tends to be a little lackluster compared to prior years. So we're not talking about KarXT, but some on the list. I think this is going to be a rather lackluster year for new drug approvals, but that's okay because we're coming off a banner year of 2023 drug approvals. The RSV products, the two vaccines and the one monoclonal antibody are having some of the best launches we've ever seen. Just a reminder that everything in biotech kind of ebbs and flows, but over the long term, just an incredible sector for creation of value for investors, but always stemming from the benefit that derives to patients.
Thanks, Josh. So thank you to Yuval for joining us as a special guest today. And thanks to my co-hosts, Josh Immer, Paul Matisse, and Grace Golan. And wish you all a great weekend. And we'll see you all next week on Biotech Hangout. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.